Card opened a locker and took out a metal container, which he thumped down onto the table and opened.
Like it?
Luke saw a boxy wheeled droid and gave a little shiver of distaste. It looks like a mouse droid, he said.
It's a mouse droid chassis, Lando said. We get them cheap. People practically pay us to take them away. But this mouse droid now contains the sensor unit of one of our Yuuzhan Vong hunter droids.
The Yuuzhan Vong hunter units are better at sensing Yuuzhan Vong than they are at sensing humans, Card said. But they are aggressive and, well,
murderous, Lando said.
Card gave him a sharp look.
Conspicuous was the word I was looking for.
He tapped the mouse droid.
One of our YVHM units can sniff out Yuuzhan Vong infiltrators and, unlike one of our hunters, won't be tempted to immediately blow him to smithereens. Instead, it can be programmed to follow the infiltrator, record his movements, and take note of anyone that the infiltrator talks to.
I don't think you should talk about your YVHM models to just anybody, Luke said. We want these to be a surprise, especially to the Yuuzhan Vong. Trickster was parked in orbit around Kashyyyk, and a group of Wookiee technicians descended on it, supervised by Lobaka. Jaina found her new cabin and threw herself down on a mattress that still smelled of the previous occupant's unwashed body. The first thing she checked were the holo messages that had piled up waiting for her while she'd been on the Obroa Sky mission. Yes, there was a holo message from Jason. Her fingers trembled as she pressed the buttons that would play the recording.
Hi, I'm back from the dead.
He briefly explained that he'd been held prisoner by the Yuuzhan Vong and rescued by a Jedi named Vergere, a Jedi of the Old Republic.
They tell me you've played a big part in a victory. I hope that means you've been all right while I've been away. Tell Loey and everyone hi. Take care. I love you.
The holographic image fizzled out. When Winter opened the door, there was a slight hiss of changing pressure. She saw Luke, Mara, and Jason and stepped away from the door to let them inside. Please, come in. Admiral Akbar's apartment was deep below sea level in Herkia floating city and was filled with the scent of the ocean. The rooms were rounded and dimly lit and echoed to the music of falling water. How is the Admiral? Luke asked. His body is failing him, Winter said. Can anything be done? Mara asked. As he told you the other day, there's no single thing wrong, Winter said. The real problem is age, and the way he drove himself during the rebellion. He wasn't young even then, you know. I suppose not, Luke said. You'll find his mind is as supple as ever, Winter said. He can still work for 10 hours at a stretch if he takes care of his body. Work? Mara asked. At what? I'll let Akbar tell you that. Luke, Mara, and Jason followed the tall, white-haired woman over a small bridge and across stepping stones, actually the tops of tall pillars, set in a quiet pool. They came to a comfortable drawing room with a central pool set amid comfortable furniture. There Akbar waited, bobbing in the pool. He waved one huge hand.
Luke, he called. Mara, young Jason, welcome to my home.
Thank you, sir, Luke said. Winter efficiently served refreshments while Akbar and his guests chatted. Then Akbar floated toward Jason and looked up at him with his goggle eyes.
Can you tell me of the Yuuzhan Vong, young Jason?
Jason spoke for a long time of the Yuuzhan Vong and their castes, their leadership, their religion, the way they interacted with each other and their captives. Winter listened in silence, and after a while sat on the edge of the pool, pulled up her gown, and dangled her legs in the water. Akbar floated next to her, and she rested an affectionate hand on his sloping, glabrous shoulder. Akbar listened to Jason's story, and then he and Winter asked a series of questions. Finally, Akbar sighed and settled peacefully in the water.
Very good, he said. I know how to beat them now.
Luke looked at the Admiral in surprise.
So that's what you've been working on?
Oh, yes. I've been working very hard on the strategic plan for the war. And now Jason has confirmed my ideas of the Yuuzhan Vong character. I think victory is now conceivable.
In the end, Jaina decided to put aside any other considerations and concentrate once again on being a good leader to the Twin Sun Squadron. Half her squadron had no combat experience beyond operating battle stations on Trickster, and that was hardly their normal line of work. They were starfighter pilots, and Jaina knew too well that even experienced pilots had a very short life expectancy when going up against the Yuuzhan Vong. She planned an ambitious training schedule, putting the pilots in their cockpits almost every day, battling against formations of A-wings whose speed and combat characteristics most resembled the Yuuzhan Vong coral skippers. Jaina's ambitious schedule fell apart on the second day. Twin Sun Squadron was practicing hyperlight maneuvers, pursuing a squadron of A-wings under Colonel Ijix Hirona. The two squadrons were evenly matched. Both were composed half of experienced pilots and half of rookies. The two squadrons had completed their second pursuit. A modest success, Jaina thought, when a distress signal flashed across their hyperspace comm units.
This is New Republic cruiser Far Thunder. We and the frigate Whip Hand are under attack by approximately 60 enemy coral skippers. Our hyperdrive engines are disabled. Coordinates follow. We request assistance from all nearby New Republic forces. I repeat.
Jaina's blood ran chill. She thumbed the intership comm and signaled Major Hirona. Scimitar One, did you copy the distress message?
I copy, Twin One.
Hirona's voice was slightly distracted.
Ask them for details. I'm going to query Fleet Command.
Understood, Scimitar One. Jaina triggered the hyperspace comm. Far Thunder, this is Twin Sun Squadron. Can you give me an idea of your situation?
Major Solo?
A new voice came online, and Jaina recognized Far Thunder's Captain Hanser.
We have only damage control and bridge crew aboard. We've slaved the weapons systems to droid brains, but it's not as effective as a real fighting crew. I just want to buy some time to evacuate my crew and scuttle the ship. That's all I ask.
Understood, Far Thunder, Jaina said. Stand by. She switched to intership comm. Scimitar One, Far Thunder reports...
I heard,
Hirona said shortly, and then added,
Fleet Command is concerned that it's an ambush.
The messages aren't faked, Jaina said. I recognize the captain's voice.
Fleet Command has left the decision to me. If we don't go, they'll order Whip Hand to save herself and abandon the fight.
I'd risk it, Colonel. If it's too hairy, we can jump out. There was a long silence before Hirona's voice returned.
Agreed, Twin One. We'll use the A-Wing Slash, so that puts you in the lead.
Understood, Scimitar One. Jaina switched to the channel she used for communication with her squadron. We have received a distress call from two capital ships under attack. We're going in to help them. This is no drill. She paused a moment to let that sink in. I want wingmates to stick close to their leaders. You are not to go off on a Vong hunt on your own. Each flight is to form single file with 2 kilometers between ships. Twin Five, I want your flight 20 kilometers astern of my flight and to right. Jaina wanted her squadron in single file because it was easier for the rookies to keep up. She watched the displays as her squadron settled into the assigned formation. Not a whole lot of bumping and weaving, which was good. Extend your foils. Arm and test weapons now. Laser bolts flew past Jaina's cockpit as weapons were tested. At least her rookies hadn't blown her tail off, which under these conditions had to count as a success. Her navigational computer lit as Ijix Hirona fed her coordinates. Jump on the colonel's mark.
On my mark. 5, 4, 3, 2, mark.
The starlight streamed away around the cockpit, and Twin Sun Squadron was on its way. It was a 20-minute hyperspace jump, which gave Jaina far too much time to think about what was going to happen. Plans and contingencies swarmed through her mind. Most of them ended with the New Republic forces getting splattered. She thought of plasma cannon projectiles shredding her rookies, or Lobaka, or herself. She knew that if the war went on, it was only a matter of time before it happened. It was not until her nav computer gave her the 2-minute warning that she thought to call on the Force. She had been neglecting her daily Force exercises and meditations, and not just because she was busy. Opening to the Force meant opening to the totality of life, and that included the emotions she was denying herself. Grief, terror, panic, horror. It meant being vulnerable, and she couldn't afford vulnerability right now. She had to keep focused on the outcome, and anything that didn't lead directly to the survival of her squadron was irrelevant. The X-Wing nav computer gave its chiming warning, and suddenly the stars hurled themselves against the black backdrop of space and stuck there. Jaina scanned her displays and saw at once the 2 New Republic capital ships, big vessels surrounded by swarms of swift-flying gnats. Far in the distance, standing off, were a pair of tender analogs, unarmed coral craft that had brought the coral skippers to the battle. They were in deep space. No suns, no planets, no moons, no asteroids, no comets. "Twin squadron," she ordered. "Alter course 60 degrees to left in succession. Once you hit my mark, accelerate to 95% maximum thrust. This is Twin One turning now." The controls responded smoothly in her hands as she swung the ship on its new trajectory and punched the engine controls. Behind her, each X-Wing followed in turn, the line of ships almost 50 kilometers long, turning toward the fight. Tesser and Lobaka were a distant reinforcing presence in the Force. "This is Twin Sun Squadron and Scimitar Squadron," Jaina told Far Thunder and Whiphand. "Where do you want us?" Whiphand replied first.
"We're holding our own. Your priority is to help Far Thunder."
"Copy that, Whiphand." The relationships of the 2 big ships she saw were interesting. They were flying abreast, with Whiphand making big rolls around the cruiser to wherever the threat seemed greatest. At the moment, Whiphand was rolling toward Jaina and her approaching squadron, almost eclipsing her view of the damaged cruiser. "Whiphand," Jaina transmitted, "can you roll another 15 degrees and then hold your position relative to Far Thunder? I might be able to do you some good." There was a moment's hesitation.
"Very good, Twin One."
Whiphand ponderously rolled into place, completely eclipsing Far Thunder.
"Heads up, people," Jaina told her squadron. "We're going to strip off some of the furball around Whiphand before we get tangled up in Far Thunder's trouble. Pair leaders, pick your own targets. Wingmates, stick to your leaders. Remember, you're just there to keep their tails clear."
Whiphand was getting very close. The enemy coral skippers had been fully committed to their attack runs and were only now beginning to react to Jaina's presence. Too late. Jaina picked one coral skipper that was only now finishing a run on Whiphand's aft engine assembly. The skip was arcing in preparation for turning and making another run, and its Dovin basal shield was probably deployed aft in order to keep the frigate's defensive fire from climbing up its tail. Perfect. It was a deflection shot, but Jaina's reflexes synced perfectly with the controls of her X-Wing, and she turned the nose just slightly into the enemy's turn and quaffed the laser cannon. The coral skipper shattered into fragments as the X-Wing whipped past.
"Rolling to right, Twin Two."
"I copy, Twin One."
On her displays, Jaina could see her wingmate matching her maneuver. Twin Two was a female Duro named Vale, who had thus far shown herself a reasonably capable pilot for someone just out of flight school. Jaina looked ahead and saw Far Thunder in bad shape. Parts of the big cruiser were shattered. Other areas were blackened as if by flame. Space around the cruiser was filled with brilliant fire. Again, Jaina chose a target, the hindmost of a flight of 4 coral skippers that had just made a run on Far Thunder's bridge. She lifted the X-Wing's nose, matched trajectories, and blew the skip apart with a second shot. Then she pulled the stick hard, her fire climbing to the second coral skipper, and watched flame erupt from its stony hull as her laser bolt stitched its surface. The remaining two skips dodged left and right, and Jaina was unable to follow. In seconds, she had left Far Thunder far behind and began to pull on the stick in order to loop around and make a second pass. Suddenly, laser bolts were slashing past her cockpit. Something crashed on her aftermost shields.
Skip on your tail, Major!
Vale's shriek dinned in her ears, and Jaina's heart jolted against her ribs.
Breaking left!
Jaina said and yanked the controls. The laser bolt slid off to the right, and she caught a glimpse of a coral skipper as it flashed past, bright projectiles still flaming from its plasma cannons.
Thanks, Twin Two, Jaina said.
She spent the next few frantic seconds sorting out her command, getting Twin Sun Squadron organized after its fighting past and in a position to make another run at the enemy.
Loey, you follow me, Jaina said. Tesser, your job is to fly cover and keep those guys off our tails.
I copy.
The A-Wing should help you, Jaina said.
We hope. She aimed her flight for the furball surrounding Far Thunder and punched the throttles. An attacker's chief advantage was speed. Once she had to slow down in order to maneuver against the enemy, she'd be easy meat for those two battle groups hovering out of the action, waiting for just such an opportunity.
Rolling to left, she announced.
That would put Far Thunder between her squadron and one of the enemy battle groups, which would mean that the enemy would have to run the cruiser's gauntlet of fire before it could reach her.
Leaders, choose your targets, Jaina said. Wingmates, stick close.
She already had a coral skipper picked out, one just beginning its pass on Far Thunder. She followed it into its run, lined it up, fired lasers, only to see the bright bolts of light curl and shift blue and vanish beneath the event horizon of the Dovin Basel. She fired again, to the same result. And then one of Far Thunder's turbo lasers punched right through the craft like a knife thrust through a bar of soap, turning it to bright rainbow fragments that spattered on Jaina's shields. The skip's Dovin Basel hadn't been able to guard against Jaina and the cruiser both.
Twin leader, you're being balanced,
Tesser's voice.
Watch your six.
Rolling left.
That would put her in the overlapping fields of fire from both Far Thunder and Whiphand, which she hoped might intimidate the Vong. Her cockpit brightened to screams of turbolaser fire, the blue and red and green lights strobing on her control switches and dials.
Skip on my six!
Vale's frantic voice jolted Jaina's heart again.
I'm breaking right!
Behind Vale's words, she could hear the slam of plasma cannon projectiles on the X-Wing shields. Jaina broke left, then right, an S-curve that she hoped would let her line up on the coral skipper that was hunting Vale. It flashed across her sights, and she fired, but the deflection shot missed. Cursing, Jaina hauled the X-Wing after the enemy.
I've lost shields!
The enemy's Dovin Basel had jumped forward and eaten Vale's shields.
Twin Two, break left!
Vale overreacted to Jaina's command, hauling the stick around so hard that her maneuvering thrusters killed her own speed and made her craft a perfect target. But the skip swam across Jaina's nose and she launched a missile. The enemy craft shattered like an egg, and for a moment, Jaina mistook the buffeting on her shields for debris until a bright scarlet plasma cannon projectile slammed her canopy like a giant hammer ringing a bell.
Vale, your six is clear, but I've got a skip on my tail. I'm breaking to right.
Her astromech droid R2-B3 gave a squeal of chittering anger as a Dovin Basel overloaded one of her rear shields. She spun the ship in a wild corkscrew spiral as plasma rounds blazed past her cockpit. Jaina licked sweat from her upper lip.
Vale, get me out of this.
I can't find you, Major,
her wingmate wailed. Jaina led the enemy pilot on a mad dance through the void, but the skip hung on, its plasma cannons hammering.
Breaking left,
Jaina called, and hoped someone was in a position to hear and act on the knowledge.
turbo laser fire from Whiphand traced surreal patterns across her vision.
Tween one, roll right.
Tesser's voice. Jaina heard the command through the Force before she heard Tesser's words, and she yanked the X-Wing around. Laser fire streamed past her canopy, and then actinic light flared off her cockpit instruments as the pursuing Coral Skipper was blown to fragments. Thanks, Twin Nine. Jaina blinked sweat from her eyes. It wasn't over, though, by a long shot. Jaina's squadron was still tangled up with a swarm of Coral Skippers, and they were all moving very fast. By now, they had overshot the cruiser and frigate, and were engaged in a fighter-to-fighter duel outside the zone of the capital ship's protective fire. They were all on their own, and the numbers were fairly even. Twin Two, get on my tail! The lost aft shield was preying on Jaina's mind, and she very much wanted Vale behind her, helping to cover the gap.
I still can't find you, Twin Leader!
Vale's bewildered cry nearly shattered Jaina's eardrums. Never mind, Jaina said. Just stay alive. I'll find you. Jaina pushed her Force Sense outward, tried to locate Vale in all the confusion. She yelled at her astromech droid to get the shield up again and took a snapshot, and missed at a Coral Skipper that flashed past. She found Vale in her heads-up display and chased her down just in time to shoot a Coral Skipper off her wingmate's tail. Right behind you, Twin Two, Jaina said, as the burning Coral Skipper flamed off into the darkness.
Oh, thank you.
Vale's exclamation was heartfelt. There followed several minutes of burning, tearing, confused combat that alternated with bewildered moments in which Jaina couldn't seem to find anyone to shoot at. And then she heard Loey's roaring cry. More Coral Skippers were arriving, at least 10 of them. This was the second enemy battle group that had been hovering out of the combat, waiting to jump Jaina when she made her attack. Now the odds against Twin Sun Squadron turned fatal. Jaina's next few moments were frantic with evasive action as she danced and weaved and fled across the face of the void. In the course of her frantic maneuvers, she lost track of Vale, Tesser, and Twin Ten. She lost a sense of everything except her own terror. She saw an X-Wing explode in a shower of orange light, and she fired at skips that crossed her path without knowing whether she hit them or not. Jaina was nearly blind with the sweat that poured into her eyes. Finally, she'd had enough. This was a fight that was impossible to win. Twin Sun Squadron, she shouted. Prepare for hyperflight. Return to origin. On my mark.
Negative, Twin Leader. Negative. Do not jump!
Only now Jaina remembered Ijix Harona and his flight of A-Wings. Where are you? She demanded. She pulled her X-Wing hard to the right to evade the bright fire of a plasma cannon. Colonel Harona's voice was maddeningly calm.
We're right here.
And suddenly, the dark night of space lit with the fires of burning Coral Skippers. Seven enemy craft were destroyed in 2 seconds as Harona's 12 A-Wings punched through Jaina's fight. Jaina gave a shriek of relief and joy. Cancel that hyperspace jump, she called. We're back in business. There was more desperate fighting for Jaina, while Harona and his A-Wings turned for another pass. But this time, the odds were more even. She splashed one enemy and scared another off the tail of one of her rookie pilots. Then Harona and the A-Wings came slashing through again. Before the A-Wings could make a third pass, the Yuuzhan Vong broke contact and ran, heading for the tender analogs that had carried them here.
Good work, Twin Sons,
Harona congratulated.
A fine day.
A fine day for you, Jaina thought. Jaina's squadron had lost 3 craft and 2 pilots, both rookies. Once the crippled cruiser was evacuated, Whiphand maneuvered to within point-blank range of Far Thunder and opened fire. The unresisting cruiser blew to bits in a furious explosion, leaving nothing behind
for the Yuuzhan Vong.
A hollow blared in the small room, and tiny three-dimensional figures swung their fists, heroes fighting evil in the days of the Sith.
"You've returned," Vergère said.
"I have," Luke said.
"And I brought you something."
He offered a package of sweets, candies made from a Mon Calamari seaweed drizzled with a sauce of jewel fruit.
"Welcome, young master," Vergère cried, and took the package.
Vergère, chewing candy with an expression of bliss, did not immediately reply. When she managed to speak, she said,
"You've come to ask a question.
You owe me an answer from last time."
Vergère settled comfortably onto her stool and popped another candy into her mouth.
"Begin, then.
How did you prevent the Yuuzhan Vong from finding out about your abilities?
We know that Yamisks can detect Force users."
"It is easier to demonstrate than to explain."
She faced him directly.
"Please, attack me through the Force."
"Attack you how?"
"Mentally."
Her whiskers rippled.
"If it helps, you may use a component of that anger you first brought to this room."
Luke turned his chair to face her and crossed his legs. The Force welled into his mind like water rising in an artesian spring. Force awareness expanded in all directions. He was aware of Idar Nilaikirka outside the room, the two techs who monitored the equipment, a prisoner in another cell, others who worked in an office just above them. But what Luke could not detect was Vergère. She seemed to have vanished completely from his Force awareness, even though he could plainly see her sitting on her stool across from him. He refined his awareness and finally detected her, a kind of fitful, uncertain presence, her life force, a faint, cool phosphorescence compared to the bright candle flames of the others. Luke tried to refine his sense of Vergère to a greater degree, but she was remarkably evasive. She kept sliding away from his perceptions, like a slippery melon seed squeezed between the fingers. The mental bolt fired, but failed to find its target. He built a strike more deliberately, drawing more of the Force to power the attack. Not a jab this time, but a battering ram. "Reveal yourself," he commanded, and launched the strike. Again Vergère eluded him. Luke began to vary his attacks between massive, deliberate cannonades and swift, intuitive reflex strikes, hoping that one or the other would catch Vergère by surprise. Nothing worked. So he built a Force wall around her, an iron box to keep her mind from slipping away, and he made up the walls of the box with the command, "Reveal yourself." And then he called more of the Force to him, building a vast mental cannonball that would obliterate anything in its path, again with the command, "Reveal yourself." And he aimed the cannonball at the tiny figure that he trapped inside the iron box. "Reveal yourself," he commanded again, and he launched the cannonball. He knew it entered the box. He knew Vergère's spirit was trapped there, boxed in, unable to move. But somehow, the tiny target eluded him, and the cannonball slid away on a curving trajectory, through the wall, into the next cell, and Luke was suddenly and startlingly aware of the prisoner there, who jumped from his cot and screamed,
"Yes, I confess. I stole the captain's shoes while he was drunk."
Revealing himself.
Luke laughed and let the Force awareness ebb to its normal level.
"I'm going to get tired if I keep this up."
"That last one almost worked," Vergère said from around a piece of candy.
"I hope you can teach this technique," Luke said.
"There is more than one technique involved. I managed to evade that last strike with a kind of mental parry, as in fencing. You know how a thrust can be parried not by opposing it, but by redirecting it slightly so that it misses its goal?"
"And your other techniques?" Luke asked.
"Do you know the definition of a master of defense?"
"Tell me."
"A master of defense is one who is never in the place that is attacked.
One can move the attack, as I just did with my parry. But one can also simply not be there. Not so simply, Luke murmured. I call it making myself small. I narrow my focus bit by bit until it becomes, well, microscopic. Tiny. My mind and force awareness I shrank to an infinitesimal size. An enemy has the same chance of finding me as his chance of finding one molecule amid billions of others. Your tears, Luke said. That's how you make your tears. Very good, young master, Verger said. Yes, in that state I can rearrange molecules, take them apart, and build new ones bit by bit. I use my tears because they are convenient, but I can accomplish the same thing with other material. I knew a Jedi healer, Sil'Gall, who would delight in this technique. I'll try to teach her, if you and she are willing, if I'm ever permitted to leave this place. If the military releases you from here, Luke said, will you aid us in the fight against the Yuuzhan Vong? Verger rolled the sticky candy into her cheek as she spoke. Insofar as it coincides with my goals, I will. Though I am much more a teacher than a warrior, and I believe my greatest objective is to help Jason to his destiny. Correct me if I'm wrong in my understanding, but Jason gives me to understand that you've put restrictions on the Jedi during the course of this war, forbidding aggressive actions. I've tried to do so, Luke said, and then laughed. My success has been modest. But my understanding is that you yourself undertook offensive warfare against the forces of the late Emperor. For instance, you were part of a party that attacked the first Death Star. You led the destruction of the criminal organization of the Hutt called Jabba. You accepted military rank and participated in numerous offensive actions against the forces of the Empire and other enemies. You didn't confine yourself to spying missions and aiding refugees. All true, Luke said. So my question is, what has changed? The Yuuzhan Vong are a different enemy, for one thing, Luke began. Our special talents are ineffective against them. Verger nodded her understanding. You have heard my opinion that the Yuuzhan Vong are not outside the Force. I wonder if this has changed anything. Luke hesitated. I don't think so. The Jedi Code is clear in its statements against aggression. I know much more about the dark side than I did when I was 20. I know how easily the dark can enter, how the dark can infiltrate the heart, even when it's most certain of its own actions. And I know that many of my students aren't ready to face it. You cut off your father's hand. Yes. You want to prevent your students from making the same mistakes that you have made. Of course. A disdainful look crossed Verger's face. That is egotism speaking. Resentment prickled along Luke's nerves. You don't know my students. You don't know how impulsive and reckless they are. Don't judge them all by Jason. He hesitated. Kip Duran killed millions. And this was your responsibility. Again, Luke hesitated. The situation was complex. I was paralyzed, and Kip was under the control of... You mean to say that it was not your responsibility? Verger interrupted, her tone harsh. I could have been more aware of the situation, Luke insisted. There's so much I could have done. So it is your responsibility. Interrupting again. The next time it will be, Luke insisted. The next time one of my students is swept away in a dark whirlwind and catastrophe results, it will be my fault. Verger's feathery crest rose. She smoothed it with her fingers. Of course it would not be your fault. You are a Jedi Master, not a nursemaid. I train them, Luke said. If their training fails... When you cut off your father's hand, was it the fault of your teachers? Verger demanded. Did Yoda fail to instruct you what dark passion could do?
No, I... Frustration throbbed in Luke's heart. That's different. I, Vergère mocked. I. Upon you lies the spiritual health of yourself and all those whom you taught. Is that not ego speaking?
Luke looked at her as realization struck. You're trying to make me angry.
Yes, she said simply. Did I succeed?
You did.
I preyed upon your weakness, Vergère said. I preyed upon your lack of self-knowledge, your uncertainty about where your responsibility lies for the behavior of those who have been your students. Her feathers rippled. Was your anger dark?
It was getting there, Luke said.
So where was the darkness? In me, in you, or in the Force?
You've been saying that dark passions are caused by lack of self-knowledge, Luke said. But Emperor Palpatine was dark, and I can hardly imagine that he lacked self-knowledge. He seemed perfectly comfortable within his evil. How do you reconcile this with your theory?
Vergère paused, assembling her argument. Darkness enters through the dark passions, but sometimes it remains through invitation. Palpatine, knowing himself thoroughly, may simply have decided to become dark, or to let the dark part of his own nature dominate.
You're saying he may have chosen evil, coldly, not out of a hot passion.
Sometimes people make such choices.
Luke considered this. Vergère went on. Do you think the Force cares what shade your thoughts may be? The Force is all life. It embraces all options. But I care, Luke said. Vergère nodded.
A good answer, young master. Because the shades, the dark and the light and all the colors of the rainbow.
She leaned forward and tapped Luke on the breast with one hand.
They are here. Light and dark are not some great abstracts in the sky, but a part of you, and the Force reflects what it finds in you.
Later, when Luke spoke with Idar Nylykirka, he said, You might as well let Vergère go. You're not going to get anything out of her that she doesn't want to give you.
The Temerian looked thoughtful.
I'll give your recommendation serious thought, Master Skywalker.
Luke made his way to the planet's surface, Vergère's words spinning through his mind.
What has changed?
Perhaps everything.
We know that there must be many refugees from Vortex on Mon Calamari,
Lando Calrissian said.
And we're sure that they're in touch with your office.
A great many of them, yes, said Fig Boras, the senator from Vortex.
He and Lando were seated comfortably with drinks in the hotel suite Lando had rented.
We sympathize, Lando said. And as you know, we brought 16 ships worth of relief supplies to Mon Calamari to help settle the refugees here.
Ice tinkled in Boris's drink.
I'm grateful on my constituents' behalf.
We have a problem, though, and perhaps you can help.
How may I assist you?
We have the supplies, but no way to distribute them. What we thought we'd do is present you with 25 metric tons of supplies. You can distribute them to your constituents as you think best.
Boris's eyes grew wide.
That's certainly very generous. 25 tons.
He was almost visibly calculating how much 25 tons of relief supplies was worth in the current market, with the planet's few surface areas swarming with refugees from dozens of worlds, all desperate for the most basic necessities.
25 tons, Lando repeated. Though there is a catch.
Boris's wide eyes narrowed to slits.
And what might the catch be?
We hope to be able to sell our YVH droids to the military, Lando said.
If you can use your best efforts to vote an amendment onto the upcoming military appropriations bill, you'll find us extremely appreciative.
Boris sipped his drink carefully.
You'd best tell me about these droids. I have a full array of literature, Lando said, and of course a demonstration holo.
After Boris left with an armful of data pads to distribute to his peers, Talon Card stepped from the next room.
It's all recorded.
Boris's bribe weighs 25 tons, Lando smiled.
It's going to be hard for him to claim it doesn't exist.
By the way, have you heard how Mara's doing?
Not yet, but I hope to hear from her soon.
Mara was in fact doing well. She had taken YVH-M-1 out for its maiden Yuuzhan Vong hunt, wandering government buildings and large public concourses. She told the droid to search on its own. The mouse droid signaled her portable comm. The droid had located a Yuuzhan Vong infiltrator, or at least someone the mouse droid claimed was a Yuuzhan Vong. Mara asked the droid for a homing signal and followed it until she saw the person in question. A tall, rather broad female human, inconspicuously dressed, who wandered seemingly at random along the shopping galleries. Mara called the Force into her mind, letting the lives of all the thousands of living beings in the concourse flood into her awareness. All the beings, save one. Her target was a cold void in the Force, an emptiness that Mara had learned to associate with the Yuuzhan Vong. She followed the target at a distance and let the droid do most of the spying for her. Mara drifted after. The target paused a moment by a vending machine, then continued on. When Mara purchased a snack from the machine and looked behind it, she saw something stuck there with an adhesive. It was just the size of a bundle of credits. Mara decided to let the mouse droid follow the Yuuzhan Vong and to wait near the vending machine for whoever was scheduled to pick up his payment. Within an hour, the money was picked up by a Sulliston male, who used part of the cash immediately on a flashy new jacket purchased in one of the most exclusive boutiques in the arcade. The Sulliston then returned to work, which turned out to be in the building the Senate had requisitioned for its offices. Mara discovered that the Sulliston worked in the office of Senator Kral Pragat, a member of the Security and Intelligence Council. Kola Quis dropped out of the race for chief of state following a ringing endorsement for Kal Omus, who had quietly promised him chairmanship of the Commerce Council, mid-level ministry jobs to several of his friends, and a branch office of the Kelmer Institute for Ryloth. On the next vote, Kal added enough votes to raise his percentage to 35. Not all of Quis's supporters followed his lead, however, and Fior Rodan picked up another couple of percentage points and stayed in the lead with 37. Tons of refugee supplies were shipped to the planet's surface from the smuggler fleet overhead. The new military appropriations bill, with riders attached involving the purchase of thousands of YVH droids, passed out of the Defense Council and onto the Senate floor. The Senate passed the bill with only a few token attempts at adding amendments to earmark funds for a particularly worthy planet or cause or brother-in-law. Mara found a second Yuuzhan Vong infiltrator. She and a squad of mouse droids and Nilai Kirka's agents began mapping the two infiltrators' contacts and associates. Primary residences and safe houses were located, and eavesdropping devices quietly inserted. Considering the alarming implications of everything she was discovering, Mara was having a strangely pleasant time.
Every morning, I want every person in my command to ask himself the same question. And that question is, how can I hurt the Yuuzhan Vong today?
Admiral Traced Creefy was visiting every ship in his command, first to conduct an inspection, and then to address ship personnel.
He was speaking from the enlisted mess of Starsider, a room large enough to contain all the fleet personnel who were stationed or passing through or barracked on the old dreadnought. Jaina, flanked by Kip and Lobaka, sat at a table on one edge of the room, watching the white-furred boffin bound up and down on a speaker's platform.
"And if you can't find a way to hurt the Vong," the Admiral continued, "I want you to ask yourself this question. How can I help my own side grow stronger?"
"At least it's leadership," Kip said, his murmur pitched to carry only to the ears of his fellow Jedi. "It's not like we've seen a lot of leadership in this war."
"We're going to win the war of production. Our factories are building more starfighters, more capital ships, and more weapons than ever before. Our schools are turning out more pilots and other personnel. Within months, we'll have replaced all the terrible losses we've suffered so far in this war."
Jaina thought of Anakin and Chewbacca, and Annie Capstan, and others. Unique individual beings, alive and responsive to the other lives around them. Replaced? No one could replace any of them.
"That trip to Bothawi has changed the Admiral," Kip said. "He used to be a lot less bouncy."
"The Bothans declared Arcrae and removed any necessity for moral responsibility," Jaina said. "I imagine that could cheer a person up."
"We're going to smash the Vong," Creefy proclaimed. "We're going to smash them every day. We are going to smash them until they are no more Yuuzhan Vong."
After Creefy's speech had worked its way to a rousing conclusion, Jaina was stopped at the exit by one of the Admiral's aides.
"Major Solo, the Admiral would like to see you."
Creefy met Jaina in an office loaned him for the purpose by Starsider's captain. Creefy's whiskered face beamed.
"Did you like the speech?"
Jaina answered truthfully. "I thought it was the strongest speech I've heard in this war, sir."
"Coming from Leia Organa's daughter, I'll take that as a very special compliment indeed."
"My mother hasn't had many chances to make speeches lately, sir."
"Regrettably true."
Creefy paused, his furred hand brushing the polished tabletop.
"I thought that I would send you to see your brother."
"Sir?" Jaina was almost speechless with delight. She could see Jason, touch him, feel his mind floating toward her in the twin bond.
"Colonel Darklighter tells me that you've been in continuous action against the enemy for many months. You deserve a rest, but the war hasn't been able to spare you. But things have grown quiet with both sides reorganizing after Coruscant, and we can spare you now. So I'm going to send you on a furlough to Mon Calamari for 2 weeks. But you're going on a special mission for me. Understand?"
Jaina tried her best not to stare at him. "No, sir. I don't understand."
"You said that you needed more Jedi for your experiment in Force Meld to work. I want you to talk to your mother, to your Uncle Luke, and I want you to get me those Jedi. I want to put those Jedi in my ships and have them link through the Force in combat."
He rose, and Jaina realized the audience was over. She stood and saluted.
"You're to leave tomorrow."
"Very good, sir." Soon she could see Jason. The next day, as she set out in her X-Wing for Mon Calamari, Twin Sun Squadron soared past her, brilliant in the light of Kashyyyk's sun, and tipped their wings in salute before cutting in their engines and flashing away, out of sight. The following morning, Mara, now operating with a pair of YVH-M mouse droids, picked up a Yuuzhan Vong infiltrator at her place of residence and followed her through refugee-packed streets toward the edge of her Kia floating city, where gracefully curved seawalls kept the green ocean rollers from sweeping right up the streets. The Yuuzhan Vong wasn't interested in the view,
but walked along the base of the seawall to a bubble-topped structure that projected out over the water. When the target entered, Mara remained outside and sent one of the mouse droids through the broad open doorway. The structure proved to be a private marina, with boats and submersibles of various sizes moored in long rows of slips. The Yuuzhan Vong spoke to a Quarren who sat behind a desk near the entrance, and the Quarren handed her what might have been a set of keys. The infiltrator then walked out onto one of the jetties. Mara left her second droid near the entrance and entered the marina herself. The Yuuzhan Vong, she saw, was inspecting a submersible. Mara approached the Quarren. "Do you rent submersibles here?" she asked.
"No," the Quarren said. "We rent berths to private vehicles only."
Mara's comm unit chittered at her. "Excuse me," she said, and stepped away from the desk just as a large human male walked into the building. The new arrival blinked as his eyes adjusted to the relative darkness inside the covered marina. And during that time, Mara read the information that her mouse droid was trying to tell her. The new arrival was another Yuuzhan Vong. Without looking left or right, the Yuuzhan Vong marched into the building, walked down the long jetty, and joined the first Vong. The Yuuzhan Vong had opened the cockpit of their submersible and were descending into it. Mara returned to the Quarren at the desk. "Are you sure you don't have any submersibles for rent?" she asked, and made a gesture with one hand.
"Yes," the Quarren said. "We have submersibles for rent."
"I want a fast one, and I need it immediately." The Quarren reached beneath the desk and produced a set of keys.
"Berth 5B, ma'am."
"Thanks," Mara said, snatching the keys.
"Have a nice voyage," the Quarren said.
The Yuuzhan Vong were swinging their cockpit closed. Mara tried to avoid a dead run as she headed for Berth 5B. Her submersible was a slim sport model whose sleek lines showed the customary Mon Calamari attention to elegant design. Mara cast off the two mooring lines, then put a foot on the submersible and felt it bob under her. She vaulted easily into the pilot's seat and found the main power switch. She pressed it, and the instrument panel came to life. Mara engaged the engine, and water jets hissed as Mara backed out of the slip. The Yuuzhan Vong craft, she saw, was already moving through the seaward entrance of the marina and into the open sea. She zigzagged around the piers and dashed through the exit to see the first ocean wave break over the Vong's canopy as it began to descend. Mara steered after the vanishing craft and looked for the ballast tank controls. Air sputtered from vents as she began her descent. Mara had no trouble following her target and doing it without calling attention to herself, though she did speed up at one point in order to make certain that the craft she was following was the right one. The target vessel plodded on at a deliberate speed, descending to 35 meters and circling the floating city until it was almost directly opposite the marina from which it had started. The Yuuzhan Vong boat checked its speed and began to hover. Mara slowed her own vessel, uncertain what she could do without giving herself away. Instead, she decided to pass within visual range of the target and see if she could make any sense of its actions. The squat form of the target submersible loomed up, silhouetted against the bright blue and silver of the ocean surface, 35 meters above. The Vong boat had its stern to the open ocean, its bow toward the floating city, and it was simply hovering in place. Mara peered up at the boat, unable to see much of anything along its dark underside. But then, through the perfect acoustic medium of the water, she heard the hum of an electric motor, and with it, a brief scraping. The sounds repeated themselves. This time, as she gazed up at the Yuuzhan Vong vessel, she caught a brief movement from the bows, a kind of dimple that appeared on its port bow, to match an identical dimple on the starboard side. And then her blood froze with horror at the realization of what she had just seen. The Vong boat had opened a pair of torpedo tubes. It was about to open fire on her Kia floating city. But why, she thought. Her Kia was colossal. A pair of torpedoes couldn't possibly sink it. Mara's head cranked to port, staring in consternation at the face of the city, at the series of clear windows that gave out onto the ocean deep. And there, silhouetted, she saw her answer.
the tall, shaggy form of a Wookiee. Trebek. Trebek, gazing out of the sweating transparasteel wall of Cal Omis's apartment. Cal, the chief of state candidate most likely to carry on the war against the Yuuzhan Vong. And Trebek was soon joined by another lanky figure that Mara recognized at once. Cal Omis. Cal and Trebek continued to stand by the viewport. Mara realized they were holding drinks. Perhaps they had something to celebrate. The Yuuzhan Vong boat swam into view dead ahead. Mara's boat had no weapons, no torpedoes of her own, but on the other hand, her craft was a weapon. Mara rolled her sub more or less upright and fed power to the water jets as she aimed her vessel at the enemy canopy, descending on the Yuuzhan Vong craft from above its starboard quarter.
Pull up! Pull up! Collision alert! Pull up!
Mara's nerves jumped as a roaring voice filled the cockpit, and her vessel's passive sonar went active with a series of high-pitched warning screeches aimed at alerting her target to its danger. The controls bucked in her hands as an autopilot seized control of the vessel. Things happened too fast for Mara to locate the autopilot override. There was an impact, then a scraping sound as her submersible rolled over the enemy craft. Her sub slewed violently to port as her aft port dive plane caught on the Vong's dorsal rudder. Locked together, the two subs whirled around each other, then parted with a grinding shudder. Mara fought the controls to pull her sub around for another pass. Then suddenly she heard a whoosh and a frantic pinging, and her nerves keened with the knowledge that the Vong had just fired a torpedo. Her force sense told her that it was aimed at her, not at Cal Omis. She could sense the mass of the torpedo as it neared, and hear the increasingly fast Doppler-shifted chirps of its active sonar as it sped closer. Mara yanked the craft to port, hoping that the drag of the distorted port dive plane would assist her in making a tight turn. At the same time, she pushed out with the force, trying to shove a stream of water at the torpedo to push it off to the right. The torpedo sizzled past Mara less than 2 meters beyond the sub's starboard dive plane, and Mara felt herself brace against the power of the explosion that would come with the detonation of a proximity fuse. But the torpedo must have had a contact fuse that ignited only on impact, because the underwater missile sped on, its frantic sonar pings dopplering lower in pitch as it raced away. Mara gazed at her displays and discovered the Vong craft lumbering in a turn, trying to bring its second and last weapon to bear on Cal Omis. As she pushed the throttles forward, she realized that the fast pinging behind her had shifted, then began to pitch higher in volume. The torpedo had turned around and was coming at her again. She pushed her throttle to maximum speed and dived down into the enemy sub, water hissing through her jets.
Dive! Collision alert! Dive! Collision alert!
The pinging from astern beat faster than Mara's heart, and then she took her hands off the controls and let the autopilot take over. Mara saw the looming shadow of the Yuuzhan Vong boat's rudder dead ahead, cutting toward her cockpit like a huge knife, but the drag from the damaged dive plane pulled her out of the way with millimeters to spare. The torpedo was so close that Mara could hear its hiss as it shot through the water. And then the torpedo hit the Yuuzhan Vong craft dead astern as Mara's boat slid beneath, and a great watery hand took Mara's sub and flung it spinning through the sea. Mara managed finally to bring her craft to a hover. To one side, she could see the wreckage of the shattered Yuuzhan Vong sub spin downward into the blue depths below. Luke, alerted once Mara got to the surface, stashed Cal Omis in their own apartment, which with Jason still there, was getting a little crowded, but was at least above water and in a part of the city with better security. Mara arrived at her apartment late in the evening to discover why Cal Omis and Trebek had been celebrating. On a vote held earlier that day, Cal had jumped into the lead with 46%, followed by Fior Rodan with 24%, and Talam Ranth with 20. Pwo had actually gained a vote, for a total of 4. Cal looked puzzled.
What I can't work out is how Fior's supporters turned out so wobbly.
He glanced at Luke.
You didn't somehow arrange this, did you?
No, Luke said.
I didn't arrange it, but I think I know who did.
Cal's grin faded.
Should I know about this?
Absolutely not, Luke said. But I wouldn't count on Fior's defectors for anything more than getting you into office. Cal rubbed his chin.
I'm not going to ask any more questions.
You're an intelligent man, Luke said. You'll work it out without my help. The next day, Talaam Ranth released his followers to vote for Cal Omas, and Cal was elected with almost 85% of the vote. Cal moved off Mara's sofa and to the suite reserved for the new chief of state at Herkia's poshest hotel, where he was ably guarded by a platoon of YVH droids. He began working on the acceptance speech he would have to give the Senate the next day. But before he began, he signed the order creating the new Jedi Council, with Luke at its head.
Ruined. Ruined.
War Master Savang La gazed in revulsion over the square of sacrifice, where the great formations of Yuuzhan Vong, each in formal robes, had been assembled to witness the painful extended death of more than 100 captives, all for the glory of Yun Yuuzhan, whose great temple was being dedicated on this day. But instead, it was ruined. While Supreme Overlord Shimra stood on the steps of the temple, the High Priest of Yun Yuuzhan had gone into his extended blessing, hands raised over the thousands assembled to watch the work. And then, a pestilential odor swept over the assembly, and the squares of formed Yuuzhan Vong began to eddy as something crept among them. The square was being flooded by a noxious liquid, something spewed up from beneath ground level. The High Priest's voice hesitated, resumed, hesitated again. He managed to renew his prayers, but Shimra's booming voice cut him short.
The sacrifice is spoiled! Dismiss the onlookers and kill the captives. The rest of you, follow me.
Savang La followed his overlord into the shadowed green and purple depths of the temple, where the air smelled properly of heavy organics.
Another failure,
Shimra growled.
Another public failure, witnessed again by thousands of our people and by our chief god.
I have 6 remaining Voxin, Dreadlord, Savang La said. Let me take 1 or 2 out, and if there are Jedi involved in this business, the Voxin will find them and tear them.
Shimra looked left and right. His burning eyes turned yellow, then red, as they settled on Nome Anor.
You have received no reports of underground activity.
No report, Supreme One,
Nome Anor said. Shimra's glowing, restless eyes swept again over the company, then settled on Savang La. The War Master straightened, then bowed from the waist, keeping his back rigid.
Dreadlord, he said. Your forces eliminated an enemy cruiser at small cost to themselves. Vengeance for Kamkarsh, though a small one.
Savang La took a grip on his courage.
With your permission, Supreme One, I will exact vengeance in full. Give me permission to take the fleet and...
No, War Master.
Give me a decisive battle, Supreme One. Let the Infidel's blood fill the spaces between the stars.
Be silent.
Savang La threw himself to the ground before the Supreme Overlord's feet.
I obey.
There was a moment of awful emptiness in which Savang La contemplated his own immediate death. Then the silence was broken by an unexpected voice.
With respect, Supreme One,
Nome Anor said.
I agree that a decisive battle must be fought, and soon.
Astonishment filled Savang La's soul, followed immediately by suspicion. No, Manor couldn't be agreeing with Savang La out of sympathy for his position. To Savang La's surprise, Shimra restrained his anger.
Your reasons, Executar?
We aren't growing any stronger, Supreme One, No Manor said. As soon as our auxiliaries are in place and the fleet is at full strength, we must seek to bring out a decisive engagement that will win the war.
Savang La stepped in.
We shouldn't waste our strength on an offensive for its own sake. If we choose the right moment, however, the right target, if we can catch their forces at a disadvantage, then we can smash them beyond recovery.
How can we choose such a time, such a target?
Shimra asked.
We must depend on accurate intelligence of the enemy, Supreme One, No Manor said.
Shimra laughed.
On you, then. All hail No Manor. This victory depends on you, who has just lost a pair of valuable agents in a bungled assassination.
No Manor wisely chose not to rise to the mockery.
Assassination is always a risky business, Supreme One. Agents may be risked in this way, but no chances should be taken with the fleet.
Very well, then.
Shimra hesitated.
Rise, War Master.
Savang La got to his feet. Shimra looked from one to the other.
War Master, you will have your decisive battle after the fleet is ready. But you will not launch the battle blindly. You will wait for No Manor's spies to report that the time is ripe. And my own permission will be required. Do you understand?
Completely, Supreme One.
Savang La bowed in submission. Luke presented his nominees for the Jedi Council to Cal Omas the next morning. Cal leaned back in his office chair. The office smelled of fresh paint and newly laid carpet, looked at the list, and gave Luke a skeptical look.
Kip Duren?
Kip has changed, Luke said.
He hasn't blown up any planets in a few years, that's true.
Should I withdraw the nomination? I don't want to wreck our chances of reestablishing the Jedi Council. Cal considered, then shook his head.
No, I understand why you did it. It's best to have the opposition inside the tent, where you can keep an eye on them.
That's why I'm putting some of Phalia's old faction on the Advisory Council, and Fior Rodan, if you'll agree. He looked at Luke.
And you.
Luke smiled.
You're going to keep me so busy running the meetings that I'm not going to have any time for anything else.
I'm appointing myself to the Jedi Council, by the way, Cal said.
I had hoped you would.
And Trebek, as senatorial representative. The Senate will need to confirm that, but I don't think we'll have any trouble. Diff Scour, the Chief of Intelligence, someone from the Justice Council, I haven't worked out just who as yet. Reliki Aklaw, who will also head the Ministry of State. You don't have any of Phalia's people, or Fior Rodan's.
I know, Cal smiled. They'll have to be satisfied with seats on the Advisory Council, won't they?
You haven't mentioned the sixth.
Cian Sov, as head of the military.
Luke gave Cal a serious look.
You need to call on Akbar.
Cal looked curious.
To be Supreme Commander?
No, but you need to talk to him. He has a plan to deal with the Yuuzhan Vong. Cal nodded.
Fine. Soon.
The voice of Cal's comm droid came from the speakers on his desk.
Senator Rodan is here for his appointment.
Cal escorted Luke to the door, allowing the Jedi Master to precede him into the outer office.
Fior Rodan stood there, wearing a stainless gray suit and a cold demeanor. Luke gave him a polite nod, but Rodan only returned a glare.
I see you have the compliant chief of state required by your plans.
I don't believe you ever asked me my plans, Luke said. You only assumed you knew them.
You interfered, Rodan said. You and your wife did something to my supporters.
We did nothing of the sort, Luke said. Fior Rodan turned a scornful eye toward Cal.
I refuse to have anything to do with supporting the illusion that your government is anything but illegitimate. I'll thank you to keep my name off any list of appointees.
He turned, stiff-spined, and marched out. Luke and Cal looked at each other.
Stickier than I thought, Cal said.
Jason spent his first day of freedom in the apartment, marveling at its strange solidity. The scratch of the carpet against his bare feet. Air that didn't taste like a rich stew of organics. Walls that were vertical and a ceiling that was a flat plane above his head. That evening, his Aunt Mara tactfully hinted that he might buy some clothes, so the next morning he set off to do some shopping. He bought clothing from a Quarren tailor who assured him that the drape was perfect and in the mode, at least for humans. Afterward, he wandered the city, enjoying the elegant architecture beneath the vivid blue sky, and tried to ignore the fact that wherever he went, he was the center of attention. Later, from the apartment, he tried to contact Vergère, but was told she wasn't allowed calls. He spoke to Luke about it, but Luke only said, "You're on vacation, and that includes being on vacation from Vergère." Then Luke invited Jason to sit by him.
"I'd like to hear your ideas on the Yuuzhan Vong. Their immunity to the Force aside, are the Yuuzhan Vong so very different from us?"
Jason considered.
No. They have a tyrannical government, and their religion is absolute poison. But they're no better or worse than humans would be if we were raised in their system.
Luke looked at him.
Do you hate them?
No. Jason's answer was swift and very certain.
Why not?
This time, Jason had to think.
Because, he said finally, it would be like hating a child for being raised badly. It's not the child's fault. It's the parents.
Luke rose and put a hand on Jason's shoulder.
Thank you, Jason. I was implanted with a slave seed, remember? And it interfaced with my nervous system. It was supposed to be a one-way communication link to enslave me and give me my orders. But I discovered that it worked the other way. It's produced a kind of telepathy. I can extend my mind into the Yuuzhan Vong and into their creatures, and sometimes I can influence them.
Jason didn't tell Luke about the fact that he was still in occasional mental contact with the entity, whom the Yuuzhan Vong called the World Brain. The Duryam, who controlled the environment of Coruscant. He and the Duryam were conspiring against the planet's world-shaping, sabotaging it in minor but annoying ways, through the creation of an itching plague, for instance. Jason had just inspired the World Brain to cause a sickness in the Maulur, the creatures who recycled Yuuzhan Vong waste, during what the Duryam sensed was an important occasion or ceremony. The following morning, Jason felt delicate, ate a bland breakfast, and returned to his bed. He was awakened by a call on the comm, which meant that the comm's artificial intelligence recognized the caller as family or a friend. He answered and stared into a pair of green eyes framed by curling blonde hair. Danny Kui.
Hello, Danny.
Jason, I hope it's all right to call.
I'm not sick or in quarantine or anything. I'm allowed to talk to people.
That's good. Would you like to see a bit of the city?
I'd just as soon not go anywhere public, because I seem to attract crowds.
If you're not ready to face the public, then why don't I get a hovercraft and take you out to Mester Reef?
Sure.
20 minutes later, Jason met Danny at a public pier. Soon they were on a craft, racing west on its repulsor lifts, 10 meters above the water. Danny had provided diving equipment for two, as well as a light lunch.
Fast work, Jason said.
I was going to go anyway. If I hadn't reached you, I would have gone with another friend. He looked at her.
Anyone I know?
Fespar Trode. She's another unemployed astrophysicist.
You're not employed these days?
Danny gave a wry grin.
We'll talk about that later.
Mester Reef was in such tropical waters that no insulation suits were necessary, but Jason and Danny wore them anyway to minimize abrasions. The water was like a warm salt bath. Adjusting to the breathing apparatus felt natural and was easier than using a pressure suit. A current ran along the reef here, and he and Danny simply drifted along.